This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. This week, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs George Moose gives us the administration's priorities and concerns in Africa.
Well, I think there have been some rather significant areas of progress over the last decade, particularly in the last 5 years. That's not to say that we haven't also seen some disappointments, some setbacks. But generally speaking, we have seen a movement over the last 5 years towards greater political and economic liberalization in Africa.
Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. With the Cold War out of the way, the U.S. is now faced with the task of defining its interests in other parts of the world. In Africa, for example, U.S. programs were usually designed to fight communism and support governments friendly to the U.S. Many people feared that when the Cold War ended, for better or for worse, the U.S. would lose interest altogether in the African continent. But the Clinton administration's Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, George Moose, says that fear hasn't been borne out.
No, I don't think it has. I think that in a variety of ways we have demonstrated a continuing commitment to Africa, whether it's in the level of the resources that the Congress votes annually for our foreign assistance programs, or the amount of energy and effort that we in the State Department and other agencies of the U.S. government are devoting to Africa. The administration's budget request for foreign assistance this year, I think, is an accurate and reflection of the continuing interest. I do understand, however, that in a period of great demands on taxpayers generally for priorities both domestic and foreign, that this is something which requires justification and defense. I think that defense is there, and it's the case that we will be making as we present that budget to Congress over the next several months.
What drives U.S. interest in Africa today? Is it a drive towards political freedom throughout the continent? Is it economic reform?
I think all three of those things. You talk about political freedom and you talk about economic reform. And the interests of the United States in the post-Cold War era are, I think, markedly different from those we have known heretofore. During the Cold War era, it was relatively easy to frame our interests in Africa and elsewhere in terms of the impact they would have on our adversarial relationship with the Soviet Union. The ending of the Cold War has made it a little bit more complicated to define interests, national interests. In some respects, they've made our task easier because it's also removed some distortions in our policymaking, so that when we consider how we use development assistance, we can devote that assistance to those countries which really do have a development priority and development need. But I think it's also the ending of the Cold War has brought much more to the fore the importance of a whole range of other interests. Interests, for example, in what is happening with the global environment and how developments in Africa affect that global environment. What is happening with population trends and health trends and how those trends impact on global migrations, and et cetera. What is happening on certain health issues, AIDS, for example, and how that development, that trend line in Africa affects us. And that has allowed us to focus much more attention on these issues, which I think have much greater salience and importance for Africa over the long term, but also for American security as newly defined in the post-Cold War era.
You know, concurrent with that thought at the end of the Cold War that Africa may lose its importance to the U.S., there was great hope at that time in the the very early part of this decade of Africa achieving some significant economic and political reforms and being less dependent on foreign assistance, but it seems like there have been some pretty major setbacks in certain countries of Africa, especially towards some political reform. But do you see it that way, or do you see great areas of progress, or what's the prognosis right now?
Yeah, I think there have been some rather significant areas of progress over the last decade, particularly in the last 5 years. That's not to say that we haven't also seen some disappointments, some setbacks. But generally speaking, we have seen a movement over the last 5 years towards greater political and economic liberalization in Africa. We've seen some 24 countries over the past 5 years that have had some kind of democratic election, some kind of multi-party election. Not in every case have those elections been successful, but in most cases they have, and in most cases that process has set in motion a steady movement towards greater liberalization. And likewise, in terms of economic reform, there are a number of governments now which are working in cooperation with the World Bank and other international agencies to put their economies on a firmer footing. And those two developments, I think, do give grounds for hope. I think we need to recognize that it is rather unique in history for countries to be simultaneously attempting this effort at political liberalization and economic reform. And that means that we need to be attentive to their needs during this critical transition period. And I believe it's very much in our interest to try to ensure successful transitions where we can.
Do you think there is a notable shift in U.S. policy toward the African continent in this administration?
I think there is, to the extent that, again, we've talked about the end of the Cold War and the manner in which that has, in a way, liberated American policy. And we've also talked about the emergence of new global transnational issues in foreign policy and their significance for us. And I think what that translates into is making a priority of the need to establish effective partnerships with African governments. Because it is only in working with African governments, effective African governments, that we can hope to deal with these issues of environment or issues of health or of economic development, issues of narcotics trafficking, issues of terrorism. All of those require governments which are viable and with which we can work. That in turn leads us back to the issue of democracy and democracy building, because ultimately we believe, and I think experience demonstrates, that the most stable and the most durable and the most viable governments are governments which derive their mandates and their legitimacy from the support of the governed. So that is why we've attached such importance to democracy and human rights as a major priority of policy. So yes, I think those things taken together add up to a rather significant change in our vision of Africa's future and its relationship to the United States in the future.
You know, there's critics of U.S. policy, particularly African Americans, who've charged that U.S. policy toward Africa and the African diaspora is racist. As an African American, how do you respond to those charges?
Well, I think policy making and policy debate in this country is ongoing, and I also think that it would be unreasonable to expect that cultural biases that appear in our own society aren't somehow reflected in our foreign policy. I think we are still dealing with the issues of race and of racism in our own society, whether it has to do with employment or job opportunity or housing or education or whatnot. And I think we see manifestations of that occasionally in our policy as well, in foreign policy. But I think the important thing is that we do have a mechanism and an opportunity for citizens to influence that policy, and that is the debate that is currently taking place right now.
And that is an ongoing debate about how and when the U.S. should participate and intervene in African affairs. You know, there was one example recently of U.S. intervention, and that was Operation Restore Hope in Somalia to prevent mass starvation during that civil war there. And just this past April, USAID issued a report that said 22 million more people around the Horn of Africa are in danger of starvation. What are U.S. plans there now to ward off a crisis?
Somalia represented a case where the United States and other members of the international community intervened to prevent a humanitarian crisis. There was no other motive in that intervention. And I think this is significant because it characterizes the difference between the Cold War period and the post-Cold War era. Here was a case where the sole motive of the United States and others was to try to prevent what otherwise would have been a humanitarian disaster. And I think it's also fair to say that we succeeded in doing that, that there are as many as 500,000 people, probably more, who are alive today who would not have been alive but for that intervention. At the same time, I think it's also fair to say that that intervention will only be successful ultimately if it also gives the Somali people, which I think it has, the opportunity to reclaim control over their own destinies. That, though, is something that only they can do. It's not something that the United States can do for them. But I think that the fact of that intervention has created an opportunity for the people of Somalia to say, let us not repeat the series of mistakes and disasters that led us to that plight of 1992. And we remain hopeful that they will, in fact, seize that opportunity. We are now confronted with a different situation, which is another prospect of a serious food shortage, a food deficit in the Horn of Africa. And you mentioned the figure of 22 million, 22 million of people potentially at risk, that is to say, not necessarily in danger of starvation, but 22 million people who may, over the course of the next several months, require some outside assistance in order to supplement their diets during this food shortage. The actual figures are not yet in because people are still waiting as we speak about to see what the rainy season will bring in the Horn of Africa. But I think the important thing is that already the states of the region have focused on the problem. The international community has focused on the problem. The World Food Program, which of course is the agency, the international agency with the greatest responsibility here, has focused on the problem, and efforts are already being put in place to respond as needed to this food deficit. And it is our hope that we are acting in anticipation so that when and if the crisis does come, we will have the resources in place to prevent the kind of mass problem starvation that we've seen in the past.
You're listening to Common Ground. It's a service of the Stanley Foundation. My guest is George Moose, the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Please listen at the end of this broadcast for details. It's my perception that in the traditional foreign policy circles in the U.S. that Africa has been looked upon, for want of a more elegant phrase, as a basket case because of some of the problems that do recur. I mean, there was this much talked about article in the February issue of The Atlantic that you might be familiar with that implied Africa was a basket case, or said that much of Africa is set to go over the edge. And I think he did also include some possible preventive measures. The author, Robert Kaplan, said that West Africa is becoming the symbol of worldwide demographic, environmental, and societal stress in which criminal anarchy emerges as the real strategic danger. I was quoting there. Is that a common view of Africa from the foreign policy establishment?
I don't think it is, and let's address some of the aspects of Mr. Kaplan's article, it was a very provocative article, and I think quite deliberately provocative. And in a way, even more provocative about what it seeks to point out in terms of trends, not only in Africa, but globally, and including in our own society, which, if not recognized and if not addressed, could lead, in his view, to a kind of Balkanization. And I think those things are, there's a reality there that we need to be cognizant of. It is true that one can see in Africa some of the trends that Mr. Kaplan has pointed out. Certainly if one looks at what's happened on Liberia over the last decade, or one looks in at the current situation in Sierra Leone, one can see a situation in which over the years, combination of factors, population pressures, environmental degradation, governments which were either ineffective or too corrupt to be responsive to the needs of their citizens, have led to a societal breakdown. And that is a matter of great concern, not only to those states, but to neighbors who would like to see that trend reversed. At the same time, one can point to a counter trend in other parts of Africa, indeed in West Africa. 10 years ago, Ghana was viewed by many as at rock bottom, a society that had failed. 10 years later, Ghana has staged a remarkable beginning of a recovery, one that is recognized most recently by the World Bank's latest report on development trends in Africa, which ranks Ghana as one of the best performers over the last decade. So I think we need to be cognizant both of the negative trends, but also the fact that there are counter trends, that there is a capacity within African societies to reverse some of the negative things that we have been seeing. And the lesson that I draw as a policymaker is that it is very much in our interest to reinforce those positive efforts, even as we are trying to deal with the resolution of conflicts such as the one that we have in Liberia, that it is very much in our interest to try to conserve and consolidate reforms and reformers where they are, where we find them and where they are taking place.
How far can you take Africa as a microcosm of what could potentially happen in the rest of the world? I'm wondering that because aren't Africa's problems somewhat unique given the colonization of the continent? And that a lot of these issues do have to do with readjusting in a post-colonial era.
I think you're absolutely right. There are situations and circumstances which are fairly unique to Africa. And the danger always of comparison is that one tries to stretch those analogies a bit too far. Again, I was intrigued by Mr. Kaplan's article precisely because I think it points to trends, some of which we can find in our own society. And one of the challenges for a multi-ethnic society such as our own, a multi-ethnic, multi-racial society, is precisely how to keep in balance those social and economic developments that, if not contained, could cause strains within our own society. I think that is one of the points that he was making. It is true for Africa as well, because Africa is, for the most part, made up of multi-ethnic societies as well, as richly diverse as our own. And so I do think that one of the challenges for Africa is indeed how to manage that diversity. I think in most cases, African countries have managed fairly well, but that will be challenged unless they can break through in terms of their economic development in order to provide the resource base to allow all people to feel that they are benefiting.
I've read some analysts of Africa who've said that it was probably a mistake to try and impose the nation-state model on post-colonial Africa. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I don't know that there was, in fact, an option here. The nation-state is the unit with which we're used to dealing with. It is the unit that people in Africa as elsewhere seek to work with and to replicate. There are definitely weaknesses in nation-states in Africa, and part of that weakness does derive from the arbitrary nature of the boundaries that were created. But I think it would be a mistake then to simply say I'm not sure what the other model or paradigm would be and whether that would offer any greater hope potential for development in Africa or elsewhere than the current one does. I think increasingly we all recognize that there are other institutions other than the nation state, other than the state and national governments, which are key to development. And we see this reflected in the growing role of non-governmental organizations, both in Africa, both African and international. And those have become key vehicles for development, key agents of change in those societies. And therefore, there is a strong case to be made for greater support for these non-governmental interventions in support of economic and social development.
I think it was in the case of Rwanda where I read that comment about the nation state being the problem there. Is that too facile, or is that just inaccurate?
No, I don't think it's a... I mean, one... The special challenge posed by Rwanda, I think we all have to recognize this is an inter-ethnic conflict, terribly profound, of long standing, that goes back centuries. It is a phenomenon that is rare in the world, rare in Africa, nor is it unique to Africa, as I think events in Europe have revealed to us over the last couple of years. But it is not, I would argue, typical of the kind of ethnic relationships that one finds throughout the African continent. Most African countries today are multi-ethnic, and most of those countries have found a way to deal with that diversity in a relatively constructive way. And I think what needs to keep in mind is that probably is the paradigm of the future. To try to reverse history and try to create ethnically homogeneous or pure states would be the height of folly. It would be impossible. It would be countercultural, and I don't think it would succeed.
What countries would you point to in Africa? And I realize it's a huge continent and it's hard to generalize, but are there countries you could point to as models for dealing with these issues?
I sort of hate to use the word models because every country is different and therefore every country has to find its own way of dealing with its unique set of circumstances. But certainly there are countries which over the last two or three decades or even more recently have demonstrated a commitment to trying to make their societies functional and make them work. I happened to serve in Senegal recently. I would argue the Senegalese have made a valiant effort over the years to deal with problems both of economic development, of ethnic diversity, of political liberalization. The recent transformation that has taken place over the last 5 years in Benin is to me an extremely encouraging one. Here is a society that went from a very centralized authoritarian military regime and peacefully to a new democratic government. That is not to say that it has managed to solve all its problems, but that is a very positive and encouraging development. One could point to similar developments in Mali over the last 4 or 5 years, in Niger, in Uganda, where they've just had elections for a constituent assembly, in Madagascar, where last year they had their first democratic election since the 1960s, in Zambia, in a number of places, in Malawi, where they're about to have their first multi-party elections in 35 years of independence. So all of these things, I think, are positive developments, which we need, first and foremost, to recognize. And secondly, going back to my theory, these are trends which we as policymakers, and in our own interest, in the interest of the United States, need to find ways to support and help consolidate.
What about South Africa now as a possible model?
I think, indeed, what is happening, what we're witnessing in South Africa, is truly remarkable. And here's a society which, as recently as 5 years ago, people were predicting quite grimly was headed towards an inevitable apocalypse, that there was no way that people could see that the profound racial and ethnic divisions in that country could be healed and brought together and anything approximating a multiracial democratic system. And yet, the South Africans have defied all of those predictions and have demonstrated that there is nothing inevitable about history, and that they're in the process. Over the last 4 years, they have engaged in a sometimes stormy, difficult negotiation to produce a constitution which may not be perfect, but it is a constitution which enshrines those principles of non-racialism and of democracy. And I think that experience and what we've seen in this growing partnership, white, black, different ethnic groups in South Africa, their understanding that their future really does hinge, depend on that partnership succeeding and working, gives us reason to hope that, in fact, South Africa can succeed. This is a country of enormous resources, not only material resources, but human resources. And if they can make this succeed, I think South Africa, and indeed the whole of Southern Africa, can become a major source of inspiration politically and spiritually, as well as a major pole of economic growth.
I want to spend our remaining time talking about the role African Americans have played and will have to play in the future in shaping U.S. policy toward Africa. I know African Americans did have a large role in the sanctions and divestment movement, which eventually did have a strong bearing on U.S. policy. In what ways are African Americans influencing U.S. policy today, and do you see their influence as growing?
Well, I think it is, and I think that influence is seen in a variety of different ways. I was privileged to attend last year in Libreville, Gabon, the second annual summit of the African-American Summit, which was organized by Reverend Leon Sullivan. That was a remarkable event because it brought together the leadership of the American African-American community with the many leaders from Africa. And it was remarkable also because of the tremendous response from African-Americans. In fact, they overwhelmed the capacity of the accommodations in Libreville. They arrived in such great numbers. And I think that's a manifestation of a natural affinity, an understandable one, a cultural affinity between African-Americans and Africa, and of their desire to play a role both directly and through influencing government policy towards Africa. And I think that's healthy. We see that reflected in other ethnic groups in the United States. And I think it constitutes a basis, a political basis, for a sustainable engagement on the part of the United States in Africa. But I think we also recognize that our policy, U.S. policy towards Africa, like U.S. policy towards any other part of the world, has to be reflective of a broader U.S. interest. And that is understood by leaders in the administration, leaders in the Congress, both black and white, that there are overriding, overarching U.S. national interests, which in my judgment indicate that we need to continue to be engaged in Africa.
George Moose has been my guest on Common Ground. He's the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs in the Clinton administration. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to order a printed transcript or audio cassette of this Common Ground program, please contact Journal Graphics at 1-800-824-5746. Ask for program number 9421. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comments about the program, you can write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa. The zip code is 52761. Again, to purchase transcripts or cassettes, please contact Journal Graphics at 1-800-825-5746 and ask for program number 9421. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.